Welcome back to Middle East Forum Radio here on WWDB 860 AM Philadelphia Talk. I'm Greg Roman, the director of the Middle East Forum, and our program is produced in concert with Gary Gamble, our resident editor, and Marilyn Stern, our producer. Our next guest on this program is someone that I have an immense amount of respect for, not just having known him prior to becoming a member of the Middle East Forum, but also having the opportunity on a few occasions to visit him in his offices in Washington, D.C., and of course, to see him from afar. Patrick Clawson is the Morningstar Senior Fellow and Director of Research at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, where he directs the Viterbi Program on Iran and U.S. Policy. He's widely consulted as an analyst and media commentator, having authored more than 150 articles about the Middle East, but the reason we've brought him on today is because of his policy expertise regarding Iran. Patrick, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for the high praise.
And thank you for not just being someone that we turn to for expertise and joining us this morning, but also for all the work that you've done in concert with Daniel Pipes, our founder, and also for the many articles and reviews you've written with Middle East Quarterly. Tell us the significance of Qassem Soleimani's assassination in a few words. What does it mean for the future of U.S.-Iran relations?
It was a much bolder step that the U.S. government has been prepared to take in the past. And what it signaled is that the United States was going to add a component of kinetic action, military force, to its campaign of maximum pressure against Iran. And therefore, Iranian leaders will always have to factor into their future decisions the possibility that the United States may react with military force in a way which previously they were not concerned about.
You've been a pretty strong proponent of covert operations against Iran, where you said 7 years ago that Iranian submarines periodically go underwater, someday one of them might not come up. Was President Trump's decision to overtly take out such an important Iranian figure in a kinetic action correct? And if so, why?
Well, it was a bold gamble, and a lot of additional work will be needed in order to make that gamble pay off. There's a potential of a high payoff. Most famous case from 30 years ago was when the United States inadvertently shot down an Iranian Airbus on the same day that the U.S. was providing massive intelligence to the Iraqi forces for a successful assault. Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic, decided the United States was joining on the Iraqi side in the Iraq-Iran war and that Iran would have to accept a ceasefire. So in that case, the kinetic action, inadvertent as it was, had a big payoff, namely the end of a bloody war in which hundreds of thousands of people had died. The problem is that Iran may also decide that instead of responding in that way, that it would respond with a sharp attack back, not like last night's attack, which was designed to harass and not to inflict serious damage, but instead a plan, probably thought out carefully, that would really inflict damage on U.S. interests, the way that the Iranian attack on Saudi oil facilities really inflicted serious damage on Saudi interests. So it's a big gamble, and we'll have to see how it pays out.
Now, you made a point in an article 2 days ago that escaped many of us. I made the video of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Iranians mourning Soleimani's passing, that outside of Iran, there has been almost zero popular reaction, as you write, to his death in most Muslim countries, and very, very little even in those that have large Shia minorities. If the Iranians are counting on strong popular support within their country to back any reactionary attacks they may have against the United States, why is it that there's almost no reaction outside of Iran?
Because Soleimani was indeed an Iranian national figure. And it's that unifying national figure which has meant that many people in Iran who don't like the Islamic Republic are mourning Soleimani's passing. There is this sense in Iran that there was a real danger to the country from ISIS back in 5 years ago. You may recall that there were ISIS attacks on the Iranian parliament building in the center of Tehran and on Khomeini's tomb. And there was this sense that, my gosh, all of that confusion and chaos, death that was occurring in northern Iraq at the time and in Syria could come to Iran, and that Soleimani and the Quds force is what saved Iran from that horrible disaster. So that made him popular among many people in Iran, who are popular is a wrong word, respected reluctantly among many people in Iran who can't stand the regime. But that same national Iranian element to Soleimani means that people in other countries aren't going to march behind his banner because he's an Iranian figure. He's not a revolutionary figure or an Islamic figure.
Right, but with the assassination of Soleimani, there was also the effect that it had on Iraqi Shia militias. There was an article in today's Wall Street Journal by Mr. Galston, which asks several questions. One, will the Iraqi government rescind authorization for U.S. troop presence? Two, will Shia militias resurge against U.S. troops to avenge Mohandas, the deputy head of the Popular Mobilization Units? And three, will the threat of an all-out war deter Iran from massive retaliation against the U.S. forces and allies? So my question to you is this. We've seen the Iranian response, and we're going to hear what the U.S. has to say about that when President Trump addresses the nation some 42 minutes from now. What's the Iraqi response going to be?
Well, so far, we've seen a very muted Iraqi response, and that does not reflect well on the Iraqi government, because after all, this was a violation of Iraqi sovereignty, these missiles landing on these Iraqi bases, because those aren't U.S. bases, those are Iraqi bases, and most of the people on those bases are Iraqis. Most of the people being threatened by the Iranian missiles raining down were Iraqis. So what we have seen is yet another example of spinelessness on the part of many Iraqi authorities who are scared because the Iranian-backed militias are quite prepared to kill not only them but their family members if people take the Iraqi nationalist stance, which so many protesters out in the streets in Iraq have been demanding that people take. I'm not expecting profiles and courage out of Iraqi politicians precisely because of the threat from those militias. And in fact, it was quite surprising to me that when the Iraqi parliament met to vote on whether or not to tell U.S. forces they should leave, that probably a majority of parliamentary members actually boycotted the session. The parliament claimed it had a quorum, but that's almost certainly false. That showed quite a bit of courage on the part of the people who were not there.
Mainly Kurdish and Sunni MPs that, as you mentioned, boycotted the event. But this points to a larger schism in Iraqi politics. Most of the Shia militias, the PMU, which is backed by the Iranian government, by the Quds force, find themselves in concert with their political allies in the Iraqi parliament. But there seems to be a reluctance on behalf of those Sunni and Kurdish members, and also even some formerly Iranian-backed members, like, for instance, Muqtada al-Sadr won the Iraqi elections on a anti-American and anti-Iranian interference platform. And we've seen the protests over the last 2 months. Where does Iraq domestically go from now in two veins? I'd like you to address Iran's influence operations now that Soleimani is done with. You know, will Hassan Ghani, his deputy, be as effective in Iraq? And two, if the Shia militias do decide to carry out some sort of retaliation, what will the U.S. do?
Well, the real voice of the Iraqi people is what we've seen of the hundreds of thousands of protesters who's been out there in large numbers, the same people who completely trashed and burned the Iranian consulates in the cities of Karbala and Basra. What we see in the Iraqi parliament is the results of effective intimidation by the Iranian-backed militias. One of those militias sent a text message to every member of parliament, strongly implying that if the parliament member didn't vote the way they wanted them to, that family members of that parliament member should not expect to live long. And so the actions of the Iranian the Iraqi parliament, excuse me, are more designed for show than in a reflection of the viewpoints of the people who are casting those votes. In fact, we've had Iraqi parliament members frantically calling my staff and saying, listen, doesn't Washington understand that that vote was meant to be a show that we had to do? We don't actually mean it. Good grief, don't do what we asked you to do. That's not our intention.
So that's in terms of the parliament itself, but I'd like to pivot back to Iran for a second. Do you think that when Trump gives his speech, I mean, I'm going to ask you to put yourself into the shoes of a Richard Goldberg, the current now exiting director for anti-Iranian WMD proliferation at the National Security Council, or even to put yourself of the National Security Advisor. What are you advising President Trump to say at his 11 a.m. speech? What do you think is the best possible outcome for both the United States and Iran?
Well, I would start out the speech with condolences to the Iranian people for the deaths of the in the airplane accident and in the earthquake that hit Iran today. In other words, I want to show the world, and not just Iranians, that this is a campaign against the Islamic Republic government and not against the people of Iran, especially after Trump's comments about cultural sites being targeted. The regime is doing quite an effective job, and so are the anti-Trump crowd around the world, in saying that Trump's real objective is to go after Iran as a nation. So I would start out with that, and I would also start out with saying that if Iran's retaliation is such as we saw yesterday, which is more harassment rather than real damage, then we can be patient and tolerate it. It's just if Iran actually tries to inflict serious damage, that's going to be a different matter. But, you know, when you start lobbing missiles up to the middle of a runway, I'll give you a hint. There's not many people found in the middle of a runway. And that is an indication that what you're doing is thumping your chest and proclaiming loudly that you're doing much when, in fact, you aren't doing very much.
And we have now the direct Iranian response to the United States action last Friday. What do you foresee the proxies doing, if anything?
Oh, I suspect that there's going to be a lot more activity from the proxies, and for that matter, a lot more activity from Iran down the road. What we see now is just Iran checking the box of the immediate retaliation. Now comes to serious long-term planning. And the biggest objective is to get the U.S. out of Iraq. And so I suspect that Iran will pull out all the stops to mobilize its proxies in Iraq to try to force the U.S. military, if not U.S. diplomats, to leave Iraq. That's very high on Iran's agenda, and they will prepared to sacrifice a lot in order to accomplish that objective.
Right, but we see the Iranians now walking a tightrope. You know, one U.S. contractor ends up being the catalyst for the United States taking out the arch nemesis of all the directors of proxy forces since 1998, Qasem Soleimani. So if there's further U.S.
And don't forget taking out Mohandas. Mr. Mohandas was arguably the most important person in Iraq, more powerful than the president or the prime minister. And he, frankly, doesn't have many obvious replacements. There's nobody else who's got his degree of respect and exercises his degree of control over these militias.
Right. I mean, people forget that you had these proxy forces, especially Mr. Mohandas, was allegedly responsible for the bombing of the U.S. embassy in Kuwait in the 90s.
Correct. He's under a death sentence from the Kuwaiti court for his role.
Exactly.
In
I mean, this was
French,
a bad guy.
French,
we can't forget
and,
about
French
him.
And American embassies.
Right.
So
the Khobar Tower bombings, the Lebanon, Hezbollah. I mean, all of a sudden, for decades, we have proxy forces saying we weren't responsible for the bombing of U.S. targets. And all of a sudden, Soleimani dies. You know, I have Hezbollah saying on Al-Manar TV, guess what? We did do it in 83. We did do it in 84. You know, all the people are trying to now thump their chest saying we were the ones who were going after the United States. Why this sudden change in now taking the blame for the actions that they actually had done after decades of saying we weren't responsible for that?
In large part because the United States and its friends around the world, such as Israel, have been effective in persuading many doubters, like many in Europe, that look, Hezbollah was responsible for these activities, and so therefore Hezbollah was getting the blame for these activities. And if they figure that they're getting the blame for these activities, then it's time to take credit for them. It was useful to hide their role only when that allowed them to avoid getting blame and being put on all kinds of lists of bad guys. But once you saw governments across the Arab world, for instance, designating Hezbollah as a terrorist organization, and similarly across Europe, then there was less reason for Hezbollah to hide what it had done in the past.
And now, the last question I guess I would ask you is, you're in D.C. You understand the policymaking circles and how they're talking about this. If you have a message for Republicans and Democrats, especially those in Congress and those running for president, about what to avoid in using this incident as an opportunity to score partisan points, what would you advise to these candidates and those in Congress right now in terms of giving a fair-minded view to what's happening rather than making it inherently political?
Respectfully disagree with others if when you have a disagreement with them, and recognize that those who disagree with the president may make some decent points. In other words, don't turn up the partisan rhetoric too much, please, and be respectful of those on the other side of the debate. These are tough decisions with real consequences, and we're going to be more effective if we have a united position. I don't think anybody in the United States is particularly a fan of Qasem Soleimani, and we shouldn't imply that they are. But there are going to be real differences about how to go after him, and we should respect that.
Do you think the president made the right call?
It was a big gamble. I think if he takes the additional measures necessary to make it work, it could pay off big time. It was the start of a big campaign, and whether or not it works, we'll have to see. But that will depend at least as much on the follow-up actions as the initial strike.
We've got about a minute left.
Not acting against Soleimani would have been also very dangerous. And many of the same people who criticized Mr. Trump for not acting after the Iranian attacks on the Saudi oil facilities are now criticizing Mr. Trump for acting when Qasem Soleimani was planning additional terrorist acts. So not acting would have been about as dangerous as acting.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the Washington Institute and how we can read your work?
So we try very hard to have a respectful bipartisan tone, but because our main contribution to the is the expertise we bring about the Middle East rather than our expertise about U.S. politics. So we try very hard to reflect, to bring information about the Middle East to the U.S. policy community.
Patrick Clausen, Director of Research for the Washington Institute on Near East Policy. Thank you for joining Middle East Forum Radio this morning.
Thank you.
Take care. After these messages, Ken Timmer.